Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Every so often on the show, you stumble onto a guest whose family story turns out to be a hidden seam running right through a bigger history. Today is one of those episodes. My guest is Kevin Ferguson. Kevin writes on Substack about California wine, about his grandmother, who's about to turn 105, and about his great-grandfather, Paul Giamello, who immigrated from Piedmont in 1912, worked at the Alma Maden and Piketty vineyards, and eventually founded the Giamello Winery in Mountain View on the back of a Prohibition-era loophole. I wanted Kevin on because I've been wanting to do a proper California wine episode for a while, and I figured we'd talk about the Judgment of Paris, Napa, the boutique winery boom, the usual landmarks. We do all of that. But what I didn't see coming was the 2001 rematch tasting, where Kevin's grandfather, at 82 years old, found out by phone that a bottle of his retired family wine had just beaten Bordeaux's best. I really enjoyed this conversation with Kevin. Let's go meet him and talk about California wine. So, Kevin, to start, are wineries better when they're a family business?
Wow. Are they better if they're a family business? I think the benefit of a family business is that there's always a good story behind it. And over the years, that was incredibly common. But as things have changed, the economy has changed, it's gotten more and more expensive to run a winery. And my great-grandfather handed it off to his son, my grandfather. But my grandfather, Mario Giamello, he was very successful, but he was always focused on having his children follow their own dreams. And that led to not having, he ended up selling the trademark and the secret sauce to my cousins, the Obisters. And so it did carry on. But my mom and my two uncles did not go into the wine industry. And I've heard similar stories with other wineries. Guglielmo, a winery in Morgan Hill, they just celebrated their 100th anniversary 1 or 2 years ago. And both my great-grandfather and the Guglielmo family that came in 1909 to California from, they're both from Piedmont, and a very similar trajectory and ways of doing things.
Yeah. We're going to talk about a lot of different wine things, but I'm curious to start, how often do you choose the wrong bottle of wine?
That's an interesting question.
It's really what I'm asking you is knowledge of wine lead to better choices in wine?
I wouldn't consider myself really a wine snob. And some, if it's a bad wine, it's often a corked wine. I don't rate wines, and it's my favorite wines often are ones that have a good story behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to get to story for sure here. Mm-hmm. When I look at wine history, and I've done a lot of wine history interviews for this podcast, there's a whole bunch of a number of other disciplines that also play in the history of wine. I'm thinking of environmental history, economics, sociology, cultural history, and on it goes. How do you think about how to select the right lens to tell a story about wine?
So for the right lens to tell a story, if it's funny, usually people like to hear those stories.
Yeah.
But also if it gets to the core of the reason why, because I've worked in brand marketing and I had a video production company focused on helping brands tell their story that engages with their targeted audience. And so usually you're overcoming if a brand or an entrepreneur had to overcome a struggle, and once they figured out how to overcome that struggle, usually that's the type of business they go into, because they want to be able to solve the same problem for other people who go through that same struggle. And that's very similar to winemaking. Really doesn't matter what industry it is. And it's interesting when you hear about people immigrating from one country. My experience or my knowledge is, in terms of depth, is the Italian immigrants to California. And as I've heard these stories over and over in my family, from my great grandfather coming here in 1912 and working at Palmasson, the famous French immigrant winemaker, and then with the Picchetti Winery, which is also a famous Italian winemaking family. Those stories seem to resonate just because they had really similar challenges. And it's the as funny that I it wasn't too long ago I was meeting with the Guglielmo family, so that's why some of these stories come up again. But they came from Piedmont as well. And as I told a story to some of the winemakers there, and they said, "Oh yeah, that's the Piedmonte way."
So, when you look at California wine, and we're going to dig into 1976 and some of the history and the changes that the wine industry gotten through. But when you look at it right now, where would you say, and I know this is a kind of a broad generalization, I'm sure, but where would you say it is in its life cycle? Are we still in the infancy of California wine? Are we in adolescence? Maybe the adolescence would be the 60s and 70s when you have all these interesting folks. Are we in our kind of peak years? Are we in our golden years? Where would you say we're at?
California wine industry, and actually worldwide, it's going through a challenging period for a variety of reasons. Climate change, Gen Z, people are not drinking wine as much. And we've had a, I think the peak of production of California wines and grapes was probably around 2017. And except for a little blip during the pandemic lockdown where a lot of people were drinking, and we are seeing a drop in wine sales, but we have over 4,800 wineries in California, which is a staggering amount compared to the 20th century. In 1910, that was the peak when we had 1,000 wineries. And then as we got closer and closer to Prohibition, which was looming for a decade or two, and in some cases on the fringes for 3 decades, we lost 400 wineries by 1920 when Prohibition hit. So we had 600 wineries. Half of those wineries went out of business during Prohibition. Some of those were able to survive because of making wine for the church, sacramental wine. And then when they came back in 1930, December 1933 is when Prohibition ended, and a number of wineries came back, but the Americans were still drinking wine. It wasn't illegal to produce wine. It was illegal to sell wine. And you can go into a grocery store and you see a rack of grapes and with instructions on how to make your own wine, but it was often horrible wine. And the American palate was not the greatest. And so when a lot of the wineries came back, they didn't really survive. I think we went up to about 800 wineries in the 1930s, and it dropped significantly after that. In 1965, I was the bottom when this industry bottomed out at 225 wineries, and then slowly started to go back up. And when the Judgment of Paris happened in 1976, we were at roughly 350 wineries. And then there was a massive demand after Time Magazine published the article about the Judgment of Paris. Time Magazine had 20 million subscribers at the time. And so overnight, there was a huge demand for California wines. And so we started to see a lot of the wineries coming back, or a big demand for small wineries, boutique wineries. And we start to see a doubling of wineries going up to the year 2000. We got eventually back to 1,000 wineries. And then in the next 25 years, that more than quadrupled.
Yeah. Before we dig more into the Judgment of Paris, I want to ask you one more broad question, which is I like to read about wine. It's interesting to me, the stories, the chemistry, all the kind of stuff. And It can be hard sometimes because we have a lot of industry materials out there in terms of writing about wine. How do you find good writing on wine? What are the things that you look for? The characteristics or the attributes of high quality wine writing?
I keep going back to this, but oftentimes it's really the storytelling, and it's a lot of times interesting stories about families, struggles, overcoming the struggles, things that people can relate to, and just hearing about how things are changed over time in terms of how one family or one company would overcome massive struggles in the industry.
What do you think was the long-term impact of prohibition on the wine industry?
Yeah, so during Prohibition, we saw a loss of expertise. University of Davis and Fresno State, which I think was called something else at the time, they stopped teaching viticulture, and there was a massive glut or a loss of knowledge. And so when it came back, there's, as I've researched and read about, a variety of families that normally would hand things off to their offspring, there, when that 14-year window can really destroy that opportunity to hand things off to the next generation. My grandfather and my great grandfather are unique to that. They were probably in a really good zone for that. My grandfather, Mario Gemello, was 17 years old when Prohibition was repealed, and my great grandfather was about 50, and or maybe 52 or 53. And in 1925, my great grandfather bought a 30-acre ranch, and he had pivoted into vegetable peddling, basically creating a. He went into the technology of the day, which was cars. He and a bunch of partners went into buying a fleet of trucks and delivering vegetables house to house throughout the San Jose area, Santa Clara Valley. And so eventually, I think in 1925, he bought a 30-acre ranch, which would eventually become the Gemello Winery in Mountain View, California. And he was able to take advantage of a loophole in Prohibition law, which allowed him to produce up to 200 gallons of wine for home use, which is funny because that's about three bottles of wine every day for 365 days a year, which is
Whew.
a lot for
You got a problem.
one family to drink. And he, of that 30 acres that he was farming, he carved out 18 acres for Cabernet grapes, and he started to produce the grapes were ready to be harvested by 1928, 1929, started to produce wine. And then 1933, December 1933 is when Prohibition ended. And in January, he was open for business. And at that time, like I said, my grandfather, Mario Gemello, was 17 years old. He was a senior in high school and was able to learn the trait from his father. And 10 years later, he took over the business, the day-to-day operations, as my great grandfather, John Gemello, semi-retired. And so that's the, I don't know if I call it blueprint, but that's the benefit, or the, I don't know if it's the sweet spot, but the right time or the age of having an offspring that can carry on when Prohibition ends, and another generation can carry on the tradition.
And you mentioned that Prohibition, they lost a lot of expertise. And then we see this period of kind of amateurs and hobbyists getting into the wine world. What impact did that have on California wine?
Yeah, a lot of the wines or the grapes that were used for the home winemaking was called Alicante Boucher. It was a thick skin grape so that they could transport it easily by train, and but it wasn't really high quality wine or grapes that you want to really drink. And that's the challenges of making home wine, and the quality of the grapes weren't the greatest.
I see. Let's jump to the Judgment of Paris because I think we need to just get into the foci here. So How would you describe Napa Valley the year before?
Actually, if we just jump into, I could tell you about the two wineries that ended up winning, and that and
Chateau.
those Chateau Montelena and Stag's Leap, and telling their story basically tells you what
Yeah, let's jump in with them.
Napa Valley was
I've
like
spent way
before
too much money at
that.
Chateau Montelena a few times.
Yeah.
I think maybe last time I was there, I did buy a bottle. I had to check with my accountant first.
Yeah. Just to set the stage, the Judgment in Paris was the transformational blind tasting that transformed the wine industry when two California wines, basically nine judges, all French wine judges, blindly picked two California wines over the elite wines. And the two, like I said, were Stag's Leap and Mike Gergich's Chateau Montelena. Now, Mike Gergich, who actually just died a couple of years ago at the age of 100 in 2023, he learned about his victory at the Judgment of Paris through a telegram of all things the day after the event.
Wow.
And he had been working there for only 2 years prior to that. Chateau Montelena was an upstart winery started by LA lawyer Jim Barrett. And this kind of gets to the getting your question about what it was like a year before that. So Mike Barrett, he wanted to focus on reds, and Gergich told him that, look, it'll take 5 years to produce any kind of reds that are worth selling. And so he encouraged him to produce a Chardonnay for early cash flow. And it was that winning 1973 Chardonnay that gave him instant credibility. But Mike Gergich, his story is hardly an overnight success. He actually had been working in the California wine industry for 15 years, and he came from Croatia. And in 1958, he got his visa sponsored by a guy named Lee Stewart, who was at the Sovereign Cellars. And but he worked there for less than a year, as Mike Lee Stewart was known to be hard to work for. He worked one harvest season, and then he ended up working at Christian Brothers, Beaulieu Vineyards, and then Robert Mondavi. But Mike Gergich, like I said, he came from Croatia, and he was the youngest of 11 children. And he was growing, the family was growing vegetables and grain, and they grew or took care of sheep and cows. But they also produced, their main selling crop was wine. And what they produced, all the wine that they would produce that they didn't sell, they would drink within a year. And when he started working at Sovereign Cellars, he had dinner that first week at Lee Stewart's family, with Lee Stewart's family. And that was an opportunity that he got to drink a 7 year Cabernet, and he thought that was really special.
Can we get into how wines are judged in something like a judgment in Paris? Because I know there's a series of judges, and is it just a simple ranking, or did they have rubrics that guided how they made their decision on the wine contest?
What's funny about how the Judgment of Paris was actually held and how it all came about, and we can, and this story actually touches on exactly how this judgment was held. And it was hosted by a guy named Stephen Spurrier, and he was a British wine merchant who had took over a wine shop in Paris, and he was having a hard time getting media coverage for this wine tasting. In fact, it was a it, if we back up a little bit on why this wine tasting was being held, he took over this wine shop, and he had a business partner named Patricia Gallagher, and she ran the French wine school next door. And they would host these wine tastings for different countries, for different embassies, because the shop was near the French, many of the foreign embassies. And when Patricia Gallagher went on vacation back to the US, she was from Delaware, but she was on vacation in California. She went to a bunch of wine tastings in California and then came back and said, we have to do a California tasting. And Steven Spurrier said, "I'm not against it, but we need a raison d'être. We need a reason to do it. We need a marketing angle." And she said, "It's a no-brainer. We got to do it for the bicentennial, the American independence coming up." And being a British expat, Steven Spurrier said, "That's is that really a big deal? That's not anything we celebrated, having
Yeah.
lost the war." But he was not one to shy away from a marketing opportunity, so he agreed to do it. But he sent out all these media pitches to all the French media, the Le Monde, L'Express, Le Figaro, and they universally rejected it, saying that if France is going to win, there's no story here. But he pitched it to George Tabor of Time Magazine, European correspondent for Time Magazine. Now, he was familiar with the wine shop because he had taken a course at the French wine school. And since it was on a Friday, or actually Time Magazine went to print on a Friday, the tasting was on a Monday, so it was a slow snooze day of the week. And if nothing came out of that day, then it was not a big loss to him. So he agreed to come. Now, getting back to your question about how these judges, how these events are held. At that particular event, the way that George Tabor has told this over the years is that since he was the only reporter there, he was given a scorecard and he was allowed to know what everybody was tasting, and none of the judges had that knowledge. And so he was able to walk around and observe the way that the judges were reacting to the wines that they were tasting. And he also said if there were other media there, things would have been a little different. Steven Spurrier probably would have stuck the media in a corner and didn't give him the freedom to take free rein of the place. So it was halfway through the white wine tasting when Steven Spurrier, or actually George Tabor, discovered that there actually might be a story brewing here. And that's when one of the judges held up a white wine glass, swirled it around, sniffed it, took a sip, and said, "Ah, back to France." And that's when George Tabor looked at his scorecard and realized that he was tasting Freemark Abbey, which was a Chardonnay from California, from Napa Valley. That's when he discovered that there might be a story brewing after all.
Yeah. These kinds of events are, their meaning is through the stories that are told about them. And I'm curious, what was the story told about these events in France?
Yeah, it wasn't good.
I can imagine. Yeah, I'm
You
sure they
have
were upset.
nine French judges, and they were. Over the years, Steven Spurrier has told this story. He passed away, I think, in 2021. But as they've done reenactments or 40th anniversary events and so forth, he would tell stories about how the French media or the French society shunned the judges. In fact, there was a European correspondent named Marc Olivetz in the early 1990s who wrote for Wine Enthusiast magazine. And every time he would go to Bordeaux, he would get complaints lodged at him about the judgment of Paris. Now, Wine Enthusiast magazine started in the 1980s. And so the magazine wasn't around in 1976. Marc Olivetz, I have no idea what he was doing at the time, but he wasn't a reporter or he didn't, but he was a likely target for these kind of complaints when he would go to Bordeaux. And so that's the reason why in 2001, late 2001 or early 2002, he staged a 25th anniversary rematch. And he decided, because he was getting tired of getting complaints that the judgment of Paris was run improperly. They didn't pick the right wines. They didn't pick the right vintages. And so he agreed to only pick the best from both regions. And he was boxing up his, and there was only a fluke accident that led to my grandfather's wine getting picked to be in that tasting, which ended up sweeping the tasting. And he was boxing up all the wines in his cellar. and he broke a bottle of Mondavi Reserve, and he needed a replacement, something that fit that criteria. And he had been drinking Jamelo Cabernet. He had a couple of cases in his cellar, and that was becoming his house wine that he was drinking quite frequently. He was turned on to it by a wine importer friend of his, and he really liked it. And so he was just curious how it would do up against all these heavyweights. And so he put it into the tasting, and they had, I think, seven Bordeaux and seven California wines. Most of them were from Napa. My grandfather's wine was the one from Santa Clara at the Mountain View. And it was a blind tasting, and they were told to guess whether a wine was French or Californian or Californian, and then rank their top five and then score it. And they were stunned when the results came out that 14 out of 16 judges picked the Jamelo Cabernet as the number one wine. And the two judges that didn't picked Jamelo as the number two wine. And my grandfather, who was 82 years old, had no idea that this was even happening and that his wine was being judged until he got a phone call from Wine and Spirits magazine, and the reporter was telling him that my grandfather had been retired for 20 years, and he loved to talk about wine, but he was just like, "Oh yeah, of course I know about the Judgment of Paris." And he goes, "But why are you calling me?" He goes, "They had a 25th anniversary, and again, a California wine won the tasting, but this time it wasn't one from Napa; it was one from Santa Clara. It was your 1970 Jamelo Cabernet." My grandfather was just blown away. He was struggling. He
I
was,
can't imagine getting that kind of news at 82 years
yeah.
old.
And he was battling cancer. He had
Oh my gosh.
he lived for another 3 years, but he probably told that story probably another 50 times
I bet. I would
until he
be,
passed
yeah.
away. But the climax of the story of Mark Olodets hosting this event was, I talked to him not too long ago, and he shared the story with me that one of the judges was so impressed with the Jamelo Cabernet that he was willing to spare no expense, and he wanted to buy a bottle from Mark Olodets' private collection. And so he offered him a bottle for the same price of the highest price bottle that was in the tasting, which was Petrus. And in 2001, it sold for $1,000. So he paid for $1,000 for a wine that, if he bought it from my grandfather's liquor store in the 1970s, he could have got it for $4.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That's incredible. And I have so many follow-up questions, but I want to kind of stick to big picture here.
Sure.
So I've seen the movies, I've read about it, and I know that this changed Napa and California wine in many ways. And in my reading, my understanding is it was another version of a gold rush, but this time with industrial and finance coming in to really take California wine to the next level. Can you describe that process, how it changed?
Yeah, so I think a lot of that of money coming in probably was more in the 1990s when with the dot-com boom and a lot of just small operators coming in. My one personal story I can share that kind of really signifies the boom and the in the 70s after 1976, my great grandfather John DeMello, he was in his 90s, and actually in the mid 70s he lost his wife, who he had been married to for 70 years. And so my cousins, the Obisters, Sandy and Paul Obister, took him in Palo Alto. They had a house in Palo Alto, and he was very depressed because he was one of his hobbies was gardening. And he number of years before that, he struck his knee with a pitchfork and injured his knee. And over the years, it got worse and worse. And back then, in those days, knee replacement surgery wasn't very common, but that would have done wonders for him. And he was getting depressed because he couldn't garden, lost his wife. And so Sandy Obister said, trying to inspire him, said, "Why don't you show us how to make a barrel of wine?" And he thought about it and he goes, "That's interesting." And a couple of weeks go by and Paul Obister, her husband, brought up the question again and he goes, "Okay, yeah, let's do it." And so, and a lot of these stories are on an old cassette tape where they figured after him telling these stories years over and over, we need to put these on a cassette tape, which we'll get to that a little bit further. But she ends up, after having him make a barrel of wine for 1 year and then another barrel of wine for 2 years as an amateur, they decided to launch their own winery. And with the advice of my great grandfather, who's in his 90s, late 90s. And so they went out and bought an old barn in Half Moon Bay and converted that into a winemaking operation. And that was really the start of, I wouldn't say it was like the one, but a lot of small wineries or small boutique wineries were getting launched in that era. And now if you look at, as I mentioned, we have 4,800 wineries, 1,000 were only 1,000 in the year 2000. About 70% of those wineries were developed in the last 25 years. Many of them are considered the boutique wineries producing less than 5,000 bottles of wine or 5,000 cases of wine. And in some cases, it's only 1,000 to 2,000 cases of wine. So that's boutique style wines. They actually got up to, I think, 8,000 cases of wine. So they eventually they had their winery going from 1977 or 78 until 2002. And so they were a little bit beyond the boutique winery, but for many years they were considered a boutique winery.
Let me ask you one question about Jamelo before we close up with some broader California history questions. Did your family's wine, did that create a palate for you where you look for notes of family-made wine and other wines and compare that? Is that your kind of internal rubric for wine?
Yeah, I wouldn't really be able to say that from because I would drink wine with the family when I was growing up, but I wasn't when I went to college, I wasn't really drinking wine with my buddies. And then I left, so I went to college in Southern California, Long Beach State, and then ended up working as a journalist in Palm Springs and then in Las Vegas for 5 years. And I wasn't really a wine connoisseur back in those days either. I moved back to California in 2002 when my grandfather got diagnosed with prostate cancer and wanted to be around him. And that's when we started going through all these cassette tapes of my great grandfather telling stories about starting the winery and during Prohibition and his history of immigrating to California from 1912. And the reason why he immigrated, he had a vineyard. Actually, he was working at Martini and Rossi sparkling wine in Piedmont. But then in the evenings, he would tend to his own vineyard. And the harsh winters would wipe out his crops year over year. 3 out of 4 years, they would wipe out his crops. And he had friends who had immigrated to Santa Clara and would write him letters telling him that you're only making 10 cents a day. You should come out and we're making a dollar a day and you can have a better life. So ultimately, he did. He left his wife and daughter and came out to California, worked at Almaden Vineyards. And after completing a big project one day, he went to go blow off steam at the Costa Hotel, which was a Italian watering hole in San Jose, downtown San Jose. And he bumps into an old friend of his from Piedmont, and it was a guy named Giovanni Beltramo. And he said, and if you're for people who are from or have lived in the San Francisco Peninsula for a while, they probably know that name, the Beltramo Wine and Spirits liquor store on El Camino in Menlo Park in the heart of Silicon Valley, had been there for 132 years, run by five generations of Beltramos. And Giovanni Beltramo was the patriarch of that lineage. And when he bumped into my grandfather, my great grandfather, and said, "Jamelo, I didn't know you were here. Where's your wife and daughter?" And he goes, "I had to leave them behind. And I'm trying to make some money and I'm going to send for them." Beltramo, who was about 30 years older than my grandfather, he went through the same situation and had to send for his wife. And so he knew what it was like to be alone in a foreign country. And so he offered my grandfather $190, which to send for his wife, first class tickets, which was the equivalent of $5,000 in today's money. And they came over and came across the Atlantic Ocean, across the train, all the way across the country, as my great grandfather was getting a job at the Piketty Winery in Cupertino. And it's a funny story on how he ended up getting this house on right next to the Piketty Winery, and the reason why it was vacant. And this is all on that cassette tape of my great grandfather telling that story. The way that we were transcribing this story as the bonding project that I did with my grandfather, Grandpa Mario, in 2002, because my great grandfather had a heavy Italian accent. And so we would listen to the story, stop the tape, and then he would translate what he was saying. And so he was telling the story and why the house was vacant. There was poison oak all over the place, and the guy who was going to rent it got spooked by the poison oak. And my grandfather, Grandpa Mario, goes, "I don't think you have to put all that. Those are all just trivial details. Just put that they moved in on New Year's Eve, 1915. And he goes, "He also said it rained for 4 days. I don't think you have to put that either. That's just trivial details." And I go, "I thought those were all trivial details until you just mentioned that it rained for 4 days." And he goes, "What do you mean?" I go, "Well, think about it. He had been away from his wife for a year. He finally has his wife come and they move into a house on New Year's Eve, 1915, and it rains for 4 days. 8 months and 27 days later, you were born." And that story is another story that my grandfather probably told about 50 times before he passed away.
Well, I'm sure it's a bottomless depth. I want to ask you a 20,000-foot question now.
Sure.
How has both doing research into the history of wine in California and then digging into your family's history of your winery, how has that changed your perspective on California history writ large?
It's a remarkable way of reliving the past or learning about your family or things that are important to you, and hearing the way that things have been done in the past and how you can use that kind of information for a better and richer life. I think it's.
We conclude these podcasts each time with book recommendations. What are a few books that you would like to recommend to listeners?
Okay, so one that is a must read if you haven't read it before is the George Tabor book, Judgment of Paris. He published it, I think, in 2005. It's a fantastic book. And I'm actually blanking on trying to think of other wine books that
Maybe it doesn't have to be wine. There's some books
I've.
that you've enjoyed that you've gathered that you would like to share that were important to you.
One book that I recently read is I think it's called Super Communicators, and it's by
Charles Duhigg, right?
Charles Duhigg. He's a writer for The New Yorker, and it's fantastic book on how to really connect with when you have challenges with communicating or understanding people, and the ways that he uses it to these techniques to have better relationships with his friends or his family or his wife. It's very powerful.
Kevin, if people are interested in reading more of your writing or following you online, where can they go?
Yeah, so I do write on Substack. They can find my writing about the Jamelo Winery as well as my grandmother's. She's about to turn 105. She has a longevity journey that's quite interesting, I think people will find. You can search for Jamelo Winery on Substack, or you can really Google Jamelo Wine and you'll find a lot of my articles there.
Awesome. Kevin Ferguson, this has been such a great time. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
All right. Thank you, Mitt. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.